peered over the wall as children, and as adults, become set on seeing the full view. These black people felt, as did I, that their bodies could be snatched back at a whim, but this set in them a different kind of fear that propelled them out into the cosmos. They spent semesters abroad. I never knew what they did or why, but perhaps I always sensed I was going down too easy. Perhaps that explains every girl I've ever loved, because every girl I've ever loved was a bridge to somewhere else. Your mother, who knew so much more of the world than me, fell in love with New York through culture, through Crossing Delancey, Breakfast at Tiffany's, Working Girl, Nas, and Wu-Tang. Your mother secured a job, and I followed, stowed away almost, because no one in New York at that time was paying for me to write much of anything. What little I did make, reviewing an album or a book, covered approximately 2 electric bills every year. We arrived 2 months before September 11th, 2001. I suppose everyone who was in New York that day has a story. Here is mine. That evening, I stood on the roof of an apartment building with your mother, your Aunt Shauna, and her boyfriend Jamal. So we were there on the roof talking and taking in the sight. Great plumes of smoke covered Manhattan Island. Everyone knew someone who was missing. But looking out upon the ruins of America, my heart was cold. I had disasters all my own. The officer who killed Prince Jones, like all the officers who regarded us so warily, was the sword of the American citizenry. I would never consider any American citizen pure. I was out of sync with the city. I kept thinking about how southern Manhattan had always been ground zero for us. They auctioned our bodies down there, in the same devastated and rightly named financial district. And there was once a burial ground for the auction there. They built a department store over part of it, and then tried to erect a government building over another part. Only a community of right-thinking black people stopped them. I had not formed any of this into a coherent theory, but I did know that bin Laden was not the first man to bring terror to that section of the city. I never forgot that. Neither should you. In the days after, I watched the ridiculous pageantry of flags, the machismo of firemen, the overwrought slogans, "Damn it all, Prince Jones was dead," and hell upon those who tell us to be twice as good and shoot us no matter. Hell for ancestral fear that put black parents under terror, and hell upon those who shatter the holy vessel. I could see no difference between the officer who killed Prince Jones and the police who died, or the firefighters who died. They were not human to me. Black, white, or whatever. They were the menaces of nature. They were the fire, the comet, the storm, which could, with no justification, shatter my body. I saw Prince Jones one last time, alive and whole. He was standing in front of me. We were in a museum. I felt in that moment that his death had just been an awful dream. No, a premonition. But I had a chance. I would warn him. I walked over, gave him a pound, and felt that heat of the spectrum, the warmth of the Mecca. I wanted to tell him something. I wanted to say, "Beware the plunderer," but when I opened my mouth, he just shook his head and walked away. We lived in a basement apartment in Brooklyn, which I doubt you remember, down the street from Uncle Ben and his wife, your Aunt Janae. These were not great times. I remember borrowing $200 from Ben and it feeling like a million. I remember your grandfather coming to New York, taking me out for Ethiopian, after which I walked him to the West 4th Street subway station. We said our goodbyes and walked away. He called me back. He had forgotten something. He handed me a check for $120. I tell you this because you must understand, no matter the point of our talk, that I didn't always have things, but I had people. I always had people. I had a mother and father who I would match against any other. I had a brother who looked out for me all through college. I had the Mecca that directed me. I had friends who would leap in front of a bus for me. You need to know that I was loved, that whatever my lack of religious feeling, I have always loved my people, and that broad love is directly related to the specific love I feel for you. I remember sitting out on Ben's stoop on Friday nights, drinking Jack Daniels, debating the mayor's race or the rush to war. My weeks felt aimless. I pitched to various magazines with no success. Your Aunt Shauna lent me another $200. I burned it all on a scam bartending school. I delivered food for a small deli in Park Slope. In New York, everyone wanted to know your occupation. I told people that I was trying to be a writer. Some days I would take the train into Manhattan. There was so much money everywhere, money flowing out of bistros and cafes, money pushing the people at incredible speeds up the wide avenues, money drawing intergalactic traffic through Times Square, money in the limestones and brownstones, money out on West Broadway where white people spilled out of wine bars with sloshing glasses and without police. I would see these people at the club, drunken, laughing, challenging breakdancers to battles. They would be destroyed and humiliated in these battles. But afterwards they would give dap, laugh, order more beers. They were utterly fearless. I did not understand it until I looked out on the street. That was where I saw white parents pushing double-wide strollers down gentrifying Harlem boulevards in t-shirts and jogging shorts. Or I saw them lost in conversation with each other, mother and father, while their sons commanded entire sidewalks with their tricycles. The galaxy belonged to them. And as terror was communicated to our children, I saw mastery communicated to theirs. And so when I remember pushing you in your stroller to other parts of the city, the West Village, for instance, almost instinctively believing that you should see more, I remember feeling ill at ease, like I had borrowed someone else's heirloom, like I was traveling under an assumed name. All this time you were growing into words and feelings, my beautiful brown boy, who would soon come into the knowledge, who would soon comprehend the edicts of his galaxy and all the extinction-level events that regarded you with a singular and discriminating interest. You would be a man one day, and I could not save you from the unbridgeable distance between you and your future peers and colleagues who might try to convince you that everything I know, all the things I'm sharing with you here, are an illusion or a fact of a distant past that need not be discussed. And I could not save you from the police, from their flashlights, their hands, their nightsticks, their guns. Prince Jones, murdered by the men who should have been his security guards, is always with me, and I knew that soon he would be with you. In those days I would come out of the house, turn onto Flatbush Avenue, and my face would tighten like a Mexican wrestler's mask. My eyes would dart from corner to corner, my arms loose, limber, and ready. This need to be always on guard was an unmeasured expenditure of energy, the slow siphoning of the essence. It contributed to the fast breakdown of our bodies. So I feared not just the violence of this world, but the rules designed to protect you from it. The rules that would have you contort your body, to address the block, and contort again to be taken seriously by colleagues, and contort again so as not to give the police a reason. All my life I heard people tell their black boys and black girls to be twice as good, which is to say, accept half as much. These words would be spoken with a veneer of religious nobility, as though they evidenced some unspoken quality, some undetected courage, when in fact all they evidenced was the gun to our head and the hand in our pocket. This is how we lose our softness. This is how they steal our right to smile. No one told those little white children with their tricycles to be twice as good. I imagined their parents telling them to take twice as much. It seemed to me that our own rules redoubled plunder. It struck me that perhaps the defining feature of being drafted into the black race was the inescapable robbery of time, because the moments we spent readying the mask or readying ourselves to accept half as much could not be recovered. The robbery of time is not measured in lifespans, but in moments. It is the last bottle of wine that you have just uncorked, but do not have time to drink. It is the kiss that you do not have time to share before she walks out of your life. It is the raft of second chances for them and 23-hour days for us. One afternoon, your mother and I took you to visit a preschool. Our host took us down to a large gym filled with a bubbling ethnic stew of New York children. The children were running, jumping, and tumbling. You took one look at them, tore away from us, and ran right into the scrum. You have never been afraid of people, of rejection, and I have always admired you for this and always been afraid for you because of this. I watched you leap and laugh with these children you barely knew, and the wall rose in me. And I felt I should grab you by the arm, pull you back, and say, "We don't know these folks. Be cool." I did not do this. I was growing, and if I could not name my anguish precisely, I still knew that there was nothing noble in it. But now I understand the gravity of what I was proposing, that a 4-year-old child be watchful, prudent, and shrewd, that I curtail your happiness, that you submit to a loss of time. And now when I measure this fear against the boldness that the masters of the galaxy imparted to their own children, I am ashamed. New York was another spectrum unto itself, and the great diversity I'd seen at Howard solely among black people now spread across a metropolis. Something different awaited around every corner. Here there were African drummers assembling in Union Square. Here there were dead office towers brought to life at night by restaurants buried within that served small kegs of beer and Korean fried chicken. Here there were black girls with white boys and black boys with Chinese American girls and Chinese American girls with Dominican boys and Dominican boys with Jamaican boys and every other imaginable combination. I would walk through the West Village, marveling at restaurants the size of living rooms. And I could see that the very smallness of these restaurants awarded the patrons a kind of erudite cool, as though they were laughing at a joke and it would take the rest of the world a decade to catch on. Summer was unreal. Whole swaths of the city became fashion shows and the avenues were nothing but runways for the youth. There was a heat unlike anything I'd ever felt, a heat from the great buildings compounded by the millions of people jamming themselves into subway cars, into bars, into those same tiny eateries and cafes. I had never seen so much life, and I had never imagined that such life could exist in so much variety. It was everyone's particular mecca, packed into one singular city. But when I got off the train and came back to my hood, to my Flatbush Avenue, or my Harlem, the fear still held. It was the same boys with the same bop, the same ice grill, and the same code I'd known all my life. If there was one difference in New York, it was that we had more high yellow cousins here in the Puerto Ricans and Dominicans, but their rituals were so similar, the way they walked and gave dap, it was all familiar to me. And so I found myself on any given day traveling through several New Yorks at once, dynamic, brutal, moneyed, sometimes all of those at once. Perhaps you remember that time we went to see Howl's Moving Castle on the Upper West Side. You were almost 5 years old. The theater was crowded, and when we came out, we rode a set of escalators down to the ground floor. As we came off, you were moving at the dawdling speed of a small child. A white woman pushed you and said, "Come on!" Many things now happened at once. There was the reaction of any parent when a stranger lays a hand on the body of his or her child. And there was my own insecurity in my ability to protect your black body. And more, there was my sense that this woman was pulling rank. I knew, for instance, that she would not have pushed the black child out on my part of Flatbush because she would be afraid there and would sense, if not know, that there would be a penalty for such an action. But I was not out on my part of Flatbush. And I was not in West Baltimore, and I was far from the Mecca. I forgot all of that. I was only aware that someone had invoked their right over the body of my son. I turned and spoke to this woman, and my words were hot with all of the moment and all of my history. She shrunk back, shocked. A white man standing nearby spoke up in her defense. I experienced this as his attempt to rescue the damsel from the beast. He had made no such attempt on behalf of my son. And he was now supported by other white people in the assembling crowd. The man came closer. He grew louder. I pushed him away. He said, "I could have you arrested." I did not care. I told him this, and the desire to do much more was hot in my throat. This desire was only controllable because I remembered someone standing off to the side there, bearing witness to more fury than he had ever seen from me. You. I came home shook. It was a mix of shame for having gone back to the law of the streets, mixed with rage. I could have you arrested, which is to say, I could take your body. I have told this story many times, not out of bravado, but out of a need for absolution. I have never been a violent person. Even when I was young and adopted the rules of the street, anyone who knew me knew it was a bad fit. I've never felt the pride that is supposed to come with righteous self-defense and justified violence. Whenever it was me on top of someone, whatever my rage in the moment, afterward, I always felt sick at having been lowered to the crudest form of communication. Malcolm made sense to me not out of love of violence, but because nothing in my life prepared me to understand tear gas as deliverance, as those Black History Month martyrs of the Civil Rights Movement did. But more than any shame I feel about my own actual violence, my greatest regret was that in seeking to defend you, I was in fact endangering you. I could have you arrested, he said, which is to say, one of your son's earliest memories will be watching the men who sodomized Abner Louima and choked Anthony Baez cuff, club, tase, and break you. I had forgotten the rules. An era is dangerous on the Upper West Side of Manhattan as on the West Side of Baltimore. One must be without error out here. Walk in single file. Work quietly. Pack an extra number two pencil. Make no mistakes. But you are human, and you will make mistakes. You will misjudge. You will yell. You will drink too much. You will hang out with people you shouldn't. Not all of us can always be Jackie Robinson. Not even Jackie Robinson was always Jackie Robinson. But the price of error is higher for you than it is for your countrymen, and so that America might justify itself, the story of a Black body's destruction must always begin with his or her error, real or imagined, with Eric Garner's anger, with Trayvon Martin's mythical words, "You are gonna die tonight," with Sean Bell's mistake of running with the wrong crowd, with me standing too close to the small-eyed boy pulling out. A society almost necessarily begins every success story with the chapter that most advantages itself, and in America, these precipitating chapters are almost always rendered as a singular action of exceptional individuals. It only takes one person to make a change, you are often told. This is also myth. Perhaps one person can make a change, but not the kind of change that would raise your body to equality with your countrymen. The fact of history is that Black people have not, probably no people have ever, liberated themselves strictly through their own efforts. In every great change in the lives of African Americans, we see the hand of events that were beyond our individual control, events that were not unalloyed goods. You cannot disconnect our emancipation in the Northern colonies from the blood spilled in the Revolutionary War, any more than you can disconnect our emancipation from slavery in the South from the charnel houses of the Civil War. Any more than you can disconnect our emancipation from Jim Crow from the genocides of the Second World War. History is not solely in our hands, and still you are called to struggle, not because it assures you victory, but because it assures you an honorable and sane life. I am ashamed of how I acted that day, ashamed of endangering your body. But I am not ashamed because I am a bad father, a bad individual, or ill-mannered. I am ashamed that I made an error, knowing that our errors always cost us more. This is the import of the history all around us, though very few people like to think about it. Had I informed this woman that when she pushed my son, she was acting according to a tradition that held Black bodies as lesser, her response would likely have been, "I am not a racist," or maybe not. But my experience in this world has been that the people who believe themselves to be white are obsessed with the politics of personal exoneration, and the word racist to them conjures, if not a tobacco-spitting oaf, then something just as fantastic, an orc, troll, or gorgon. "I am not a racist," an entertainer once insisted after being filmed repeatedly yelling at a heckler, "He's a nigger, he's a nigger." Considering segregationist Senator Strom Thurmond, Richard Nixon concluded, "Strom is no racist." There are no racists in America, or at least none that the people who need to be white know personally. In the era of mass lynching, it was so difficult to find who specifically served as executioner that such deaths were often reported by the press as having happened at the hands of persons unknown. In 1957, the white residents of Levittown, Pennsylvania, argued for their right to keep their town segregated. "As moral, religious, and law-abiding citizens," the group wrote, "we feel that we are unprejudiced and undiscriminating in our wish to keep our community a closed community." This was the attempt to commit a shameful act while escaping all sanction, and I raise it to show you that there was no golden era when evildoers did their business and loudly proclaimed it as such. We would prefer to say that such people cannot exist, that there aren't any right Solzhenitsyn. To do evil, a human being must first of all believe that what he's doing is good, or else that it's a well-considered act in conformity with natural law. This is the foundation of the dream. Its adherents must not just believe in it, but believe that it is just, believe that their possession of the dream is the natural result of grit, honor, and good works. There is some passing acknowledgement of the bad old days, which, by the way, were not so bad as to have any ongoing effects on our present. The metal that it takes to look away from the horror of our prison system, from police forces transformed into armies, from the long war against the black body is not forged overnight. This is the practiced habit of jabbing out one's eyes and forgetting the work of one's hands. To acknowledge these horrors means turning away from the brightly rendered version of your country as it has always declared itself and turning towards something murkier and unknown. It is still too difficult for most Americans to do this, but that is your work. It must be, if only to preserve the sanctity of your mind. The entire narrative of this country argues against the truth of who you are. I think of that summer that you may well remember when I loaded you and your cousin Christopher into the back seat of a rented car and pushed out to see what remained of Petersburg, Shirley Plantation, and the wilderness. I was obsessed with the Civil War because 600,000 people had died in it, and yet it had been glossed over in my education and in popular culture. Representations of the war and its reasons seemed obscured. And yet I knew that in 1859 we were enslaved and in 1865 we were not. And what happened to us in those years struck me as having some amount of import. But whenever I visited any of the battlefields, I felt like I was greeted as if I were a nosy accountant conducting an audit and someone was trying to hide the books. I don't know if you remember how the film we saw at the Petersburg battlefield ended, as though the fall of the Confederacy were the onset of a tragedy, not jubilee. I doubt you remember the man on our tour dressed in the gray wool of the Confederacy, or how every visitor seemed most interested in flanking maneuvers, hardtack, smoothbore rifles, grapeshot, and ironclads, but virtually no one was interested in what all of this engineering, invention, and design had been marshaled to achieve. You were only 10 years old. But even then I knew that I must trouble you. And this meant taking you into rooms where people would insult your intelligence, where thieves would try to enlist you in your own robbery and disguise their burning and looting as Christian charity. But robbery is what this is, what it always was. At the onset of the Civil War, our stolen bodies were worth $4 billion, more than all of the American industry, all of the American railroads, workshops, and factories combined. And the prime product rendered by our stolen bodies, cotton, was America's primary export. The richest men in America lived in the Mississippi River Valley, and they made their riches off our stolen bodies. Our bodies were held in bondage by the early presidents. Our bodies were traded from the White House by James K. Polk. Our bodies built the Capitol and the National Mall. The first shot of the Civil War was fired in South Carolina, where our bodies constituted the majority of human bodies in the state. Here is the motive for the Great War. It's not a secret. But we can do better and find the bandit confessing his crime. Our position is thoroughly identified with the institution of slavery, declared Mississippi as it left the Union, the greatest material interest of the world. Do you remember standing with me and your mother during one of our visits to Gettysburg outside the home of Abraham Bryan? We were with a young man who'd educated himself on the history of black people in Gettysburg. He explained that Bryan Farm was the far end of the line that was charged by George Pickett on the final day of Gettysburg. He told us that Bryan was a black man, that Gettysburg was home to a free black community, that Bryan and his family fled their home for fear of losing their bodies to the advancing army of enslavement, led by the honored and holy Confederate general, Robert E. Lee, whose army was then stealing black people from themselves and selling them south. George Pickett and his troops were repulsed by the Union Army. Standing there a century and a half later, I thought of one of Faulkner's characters famously recalling how this failure tantalized the minds of all Southern boys. It's all in the balance. It hasn't happened yet. It hasn't even begun. All of Faulkner's Southern boys were white. But I, standing on the farm of a black man who fled with his family to stay free of the South, saw Pickett's soldiers charging through history in wild pursuit of their strange birthright, the right to beat, rape, rob, and pillage the black body. That is all of what was in the balance, the nostalgic moment's corrupt and unspeakable core. but American Reunion was built on a comfortable narrative that made enslavement into benevolence, white knights of body snatchers, and the mass slaughter of the war into a kind of sport in which one could conclude that both sides conducted their affairs with courage, honor, and elan. This lie of the Civil War is the lie of innocence, is the dream. Historians conjured the dream. Hollywood fortified the dream. The dream was gilded by novels and adventure stories. John Carter flees the broken Confederacy for Mars. We are not supposed to ask what precisely he was running from. I, like every kid I knew, loved the Dukes of Hazzard, but I would have done well to think more about why two outlaws driving a car named the General Lee must necessarily be portrayed as just some good old boys, never meaning no harm, a mantra for the dreamers if there ever was one. But what one means is neither important nor relevant. It is not necessary that you believe that the officer who choked Eric Garner set out that day to destroy a body. All you need to understand is that the officer carries with him the power of the American state and the weight of an American legacy, and they necessitate that of the bodies destroyed every year, some wild and disproportionate number of them will be black. Here is what I would like you to know. In America, it is traditional to destroy the black body. It is heritage. Enslavement was not merely the antiseptic borrowing of labor. It is not so easy to get a human being to commit their body against its own elemental interests. And so enslavement must be casual wrath and random manglings, the gashing of heads and brains blown out over the river as the body seeks to escape. It must be rape so regular as to be industrial. There is no uplifting way to say this. I have no praise anthems nor old Negro spirituals. The spirit and soul are the body and brain, which are destructible. That is precisely why they are so precious. And the soul did not escape. The spirit did not steal away on gospel wings. The soul was the body that fed the tobacco, and the spirit was the blood that watered the cotton. And these created the first fruits of the American garden. And the fruits were secured through the bashing of children with stove wood, through hot iron peeling skin away, like husk from corn. It had to be blood. It had to be nails driven through the tongue and ears pruned away. Some disobedience, wrote a southern mistress. Much idleness, sullenness, slovenliness used the rod. It had to be the thrashing of kitchen hands for the crime of churning butter at a leisurely clip. It had to be some woman cheered with 30 lashes a Saturday last and as many more a Tuesday again. It could only be the employment of carriage whips, tongs, iron pokers, handsaws, stones, paperweights, or whatever might be handy to break the black body, the black family, the black community, the black nation. The bodies were pulverized into stock and marked with insurance. And the bodies were an aspiration, lucrative as Indian land, a veranda, a beautiful wife, or a summer home in the mountains. For the men who needed to believe themselves white, the bodies were the key to a social club, and the right to break the bodies was the mark of civilization. The two great divisions of society are not the rich and poor, but white and black, said the great South Carolina Senator John C. Calhoun. And all the former, the poor as well as the rich, belong to the upper class and are respected and treated as equals. And there it is, the right to break the black body as the meaning of their sacred equality. And that right has always given them meaning, has always meant that there was someone down in the valley, because a mountain is not a mountain if there is nothing below. You and I, my son, are that below. That was true in 1776. It is true today. There is no them without you, and without the right to break you, they must necessarily fall from the mountain, lose their divinity, and tumble out of the dream. And then they would have to determine how to build their suburbs on something other than human bones, how to angle their jails towards something other than a human stockyard, how to erect a democracy independent of cannibalism. But because they believe themselves to be white, they would rather countenance a man choked to death on film under their laws, and they would rather subscribe to the myth of Trayvon Martin, slight teenager, hands full of candy and soft drinks, transforming into a murderous juggernaut, and they would rather see Prince Jones followed by a bad cop through three jurisdictions and shot down for acting like a human. And they would rather reach out in all their sanity and push my 4-year-old son as though he were merely an obstacle in the path of their too important day. I was there, Samari. No, I was back in Baltimore, surrounded by them boys. I was on my parents' living room floor, staring out at that distant world impenetrable to me. I was in all the anger of my years. I was where Eric Garner must have been in his last moments. "This stops today," he said, and was killed. I felt the cosmic injustice, even though I did not fully understand it. I had not yet been to Gettysburg. I had not yet read the Volia Glumph. All I had was the feeling, the weight. I did not yet know, and I do not fully know now. But part of what I know is that there is the burden of living among dreamers, and there is the extra burden of your country telling you the dream is just, noble, and real, and you are crazy for seeing the corruption and smelling the sulfur. For their innocence, they nullify your anger, your fear, until you are coming and going, and you find yourself inveighing against yourself. Black people are the only people who, really inveighing against your own humanity and raging against the crime in your ghetto because you were powerless before the great crime of history that brought the ghettos to be. It is truly horrible to understand yourself as the essential below of your country. It breaks too much of what we would like to think about ourselves, our lives, the world we move through, and the people who surround us. The struggle to understand is our only advantage over this madness. By the time I visited those battlefields, I knew that they had been retrofitted as the staging ground for a great deception, and this was my only security, because they could no longer insult me by lying to me. I knew, and the most important thing I knew was that somewhere, deep within them, they knew too. I like to think that knowing might have kept me from endangering you, that having understood and acknowledged the anger, I could control it. I like to think that it could have allowed me to speak the needed words to the woman and then walk away. I like to think this, but I can't promise it. The struggle is really all I have for you, because it is the only portion of this world under your control. I am sorry that I cannot make it okay. I am sorry that I cannot save you, but not that sorry. Part of me thinks that your very vulnerability brings you closer to the meaning of life. Just as for others, the quest to believe oneself white divides them from it. The fact is that despite their dreams, their lives are not so inviolable. When their own vulnerability becomes real, when the police decide that tactics intended for the ghetto should enjoy wider usage, when their armed society shoots down their children, when nature sends hurricanes against their cities, they are shocked in a way that those of us who were born and bred to understand cause and effect can never be. And I would not have you live like them. You have been cast into a race in which the wind is always at your face and the hounds are always at your heels. And to varying degrees, this is true of all life. The difference is that you do not have the privilege of living in ignorance of this essential fact. I am speaking to you as I always have, as the sober and serious man I have always wanted you to be, who does not apologize for his human feelings, who does not make excuses for his height, his long arms, his beautiful smile. You are growing into consciousness, and my wish for you is that you feel no need to constrict yourself to make other people comfortable. None of that can change the math anyway. I never wanted you to be twice as good as them, so much as I have always wanted you to attack every day of your brief, bright life in struggle. The people who must believe they are white can never be your measuring stick. I would not have you descend into your own dream. I would have you be a conscious citizen of this terrible and beautiful world. One day I was in Chicago, reporting a story about the history of segregation in the urban North and how it was engineered by government policy. I was trailing some officers of the county sheriff as they made their rounds. That day I saw a black man losing his home. I followed the sheriff's officers inside the house where a group of them were talking to the man's wife, who was also trying to tend to her two children. She had clearly not been warned that the sheriff would be coming, though something in her husband's demeanor told me that he must have known. His wife's eyes registered all at once, shock at the circumstance, anger at the officers, and anger at her husband. The officers stood in the man's living room giving him orders as to what would now happen. Outside, there were men who'd been hired to remove the family's possessions. The man was humiliated, and I imagined that he had probably for some time carried in his head, alone, all that was threatening his family, but could not bring himself to admit it to himself or his wife. So he now changed all that energy into anger directed at the officers. He cursed, he yelled, he pointed wildly. This particular sheriff's department was more progressive than most. They were concerned about mass incarceration. They would often bring a social worker to an eviction. But this had nothing to do with the underlying and relentless logic of the world this man inhabited. A logic built on laws, built on history, built on contempt for this man and his family and their fate. The man ran it on. When the officers turned away, he ran it more to the group of black men assembled who'd been hired to sit his family out on the street. His manner was like all the powerless black people I'd ever known, exaggerating their bodies to conceal a fundamental plunder that they could not prevent. I had spent the week exploring this city, walking through its vacant lots, watching the aimless boys sitting in the pews of the striving churches, reeling before the street murals to the dead, and I would from time to time sit in the humble homes of black people in that city who were entering their 10th decade of life. These people were profound. Their homes were filled with the emblems of honorable life, citizenship awards, portraits of husbands and wives passed away, several generations of children in cap and gown. And they had drawn these accolades by cleaning big houses and living in one-room Alabama shacks before moving to the city. And they had done this despite the city, which was supposed to be a respite, revealing itself to simply be a more intricate specimen of plunder. They had worked 2 and 3 jobs, put children through high school and college, and become pillars of their community. I admired them, but I knew the whole time that I was merely encountering the survivors, the ones who'd endured the banks and their stone-faced contempt, the realtors and their fake sympathy. I'm sorry, that house just sold yesterday. The realtors who steered them back toward ghetto blocks, or blocks earmarked to be ghetto soon. The lenders who found this captive class and tried to strip them of everything they had. In those homes, I saw the best of us, but behind each of them, I knew that there were so many millions gone. And I knew that there were children born into these same caged neighborhoods on the west side, these ghettos, each of which was as planned as any subdivision. They are an elegant act of racism, killing fields authored by federal policies, where we are, all again, plundered of our dignity, of our families, of our wealth, and of our lives. And there is no difference between the killing of Prince Jones and the murders attending these killing fields, because both are rooted in the assumed inhumanity of black people. A legacy of plunder, a network of laws and traditions, a heritage, a dream, murdered Prince Jones as sure as it murders black people in North Lawndale with frightening regularity. Black-on-black crime is jargon, violence to language, which vanishes the men who engineered the covenants, who fixed the loans, who planned the projects, who built the streets, and sold red ink by the barrel. And this should not surprise us. The plunder of black life was drilled into this country in its infancy and reinforced across its history, so that plunder has become an heirloom, an intelligence, a sentience, a default setting to which, likely to the end of our days, we must invariably return. The killing fields of Chicago, of Baltimore, of Detroit, were created by the policy of dreamers, but their weight, their shame, rests solely upon those who are dying in them. There is a great deception in this. To yell black on black crime is to shoot a man and then shame him for bleeding. And the premise that allows for these killing fields, the reduction of the black body, is no different than the premise that allowed for the murder of Prince Jones, the dream of acting white, of talking white, of being white, murdered Prince Jones as sure as it murders black people in Chicago with frightening regularity. Do not accept the lie. Do not drink from poison. The same hands that drew red lines around the life of Prince Jones drew red lines around the ghetto. I did not want to raise you in fear or false memory. I did not want you forced to mask your joys and bind your eyes. What I wanted for you was to grow into consciousness. I resolved to hide nothing from you. Do you remember when I first took you to work when you were 13? I was going to see the mother of a dead black boy. The boy had exchanged hard words with a white man and been killed because he refused to turn down his music. The killer, having emptied his gun, drove his girlfriend to a hotel. They had drinks. They ordered a pizza. And then the next day at his leisure, the man turned himself in. The man claimed to have seen a shotgun. He claimed to have been in fear for his life and to only have triumphed through righteous violence. I was the victim and the victor, he asserted, much as generations of American plunderers had asserted before. No shotgun was ever found. The claim still influenced the jury, and the killer was convicted, not of the boy's murder, but of firing repeatedly as the boy's friends tried to retreat. Destroying the black body was permissible, but it would be better to do it efficiently. The mother of this murdered black boy was then taking her case before journalists and writers. We met her in the lobby of her Times Square hotel. She was medium height with brown skin and hair down to her shoulders. It had not even been a week since the verdict, but she was composed and wholly self-possessed. She did not rage at the killer, but wondered aloud if the rules she'd imparted had been enough. She had wanted her son to stand for what he believed and to be respectful, and he had died for believing his friends had a right to play their music loud, to be American teenagers. Still, she was left wondering. In my mind, I keep saying, had he not spoke back, spoke up, would he still be here? She would not forget the uniqueness of her son, his singular life. She would not forget that he had a father who loved him, who took him in while she battled cancer. She would not forget that he was the life of the party, that he always had new friends for her to shuttle around in her minivan. And she would have him live on in her work. I told her the verdict angered me. I told her that the idea that someone on that jury thought it plausible there was a gun in the car baffled the mind. She said that she was baffled too, and that I should not mistake her calm probing for the absence of anger. But God had focused her anger away from revenge and toward redemption, she said. God had spoken to her and committed her to a new activism. Then the mother of the murdered boy rose, turned to you and said, "You exist. You matter. You have value. You have every right to wear your hoodie, to play your music as loud as you want. You have every right to be you, and no one should deter you from being you. You have to be you, and you can never be afraid to be you." I was glad she said this. I have tried to say the same to you, and if I have not said it with the same direction and clarity, I confess that is because I am afraid. And I have no guard to hold me up, and I believe that when they shatter the body, they shatter everything. And I knew that all of us, Christians, Muslims, atheists, lived in this fear of this truth. Disembodiment is a kind of terrorism, and the threat of it alters the orbit of all of our lives, and like terrorism, this distortion is intentional. Disembodiment, the dragon that compelled the boys I knew way back into extravagant theater of ownership. Disembodiment, the demon that pushed the black middle class survivors into aggressive passivity. Our conversation restrained in public quarters. Our best manners on display. Our hands never out of pockets. Our whole manner ordered as if to say, "I make no sudden moves." Disembodiment, the serpent of school years, demanding I be twice as good, though I was but a boy. Murder was all around us, and we knew, deep in ourselves, in some silent space, that the author of these murders was beyond us, that it suited some other person's ends. We were right. Here is how I take the measure of my progress in life. I imagine myself as I was, back there in West Baltimore, dodging North and Pulaski, ducking Murphy Holmes, fearful of the schools and the streets, and I imagine showing that lost boy a portrait of my present life and asking him what he would make of it. Only once, in the 2 years after your birth, in the first 2 rounds of the fight of my life, have I believed he would have been disappointed. I write you at the precipice of my 40th year, having come to a point in my life, not of great prominence, but far beyond anything that boy could have even imagined. I did not master the streets because I could not read the body language quick enough. I did not master the schools because I could not see where any of it could possibly lead. But I did not fall. I have my family. I have my work. I no longer feel it necessary to hang my head at parties and tell people that I am trying to be a writer. And godless though I am, the fact of being human, the fact of possessing the gift of study, and thus being remarkable among all the matter floating through the cosmos, still awes me. I have spent much of my study searching for the right question by which I might fully understand the breach between the world and me. I have not spent my time studying the problem of race. Race itself is just a restatement and retrenchment of the problem. You see this from time to time when some dullard, usually believing himself white, proposes that the way forward is a grand orgy of black and white, ending only when we are all beige, and thus the same race. But a great number of black people already are beige, and the history of civilization is littered with dead races, Frankish, Italian, German, Irish, later abandoned because they no longer serve their purpose, the organization of people beneath and beyond the umbrella of rights. If my life ended today, I would tell you that it was a happy life, that I drew great joy from the study, from the struggle toward which I now urge you. You have seen in this conversation that the struggle has ruptured and remade me several times over, in Baltimore, at the Mecca, in fatherhood, in New York. The changes have awarded me a rapture that comes only when you can no longer be lied to, when you have rejected the dream. But even more, the changes have taught me how to best exploit that singular gift of study, to question what I see, then to question what I see after that, because the questions matter as much, perhaps more than, the answers. But oh my eyes. When I was a boy, no portion of my body suffered more than my eyes. If I have done well by the measure of childhood, it must be added that those measures themselves are hampered by how little a boy of my captive class had seen. The dream seemed to be the pinnacle then, to grow rich and live in one of those disconnected houses out in the country, in one of those small communities, one of those cul-de-sacs with its gently curving ways, where they staged teen movies and children built tree houses, and in that last lost year before college, teenagers made love and cars parked at the lake. The dream seemed to be the end of the world for me, the height of American ambition. What more could possibly exist beyond the dispatches, beyond the suburbs? Your mother knew. Perhaps it was because she was raised within the physical borders of such a place, because she lived in proximity with the dreamers. Perhaps it was because the people who thought they were white told her she was smart and followed this up by telling her she was not really black, meaning it as a compliment. Perhaps it was the boys out there, who were in fact black, telling her she was pretty for a dark-skinned girl. Your mother never felt quite at home, and this made the possibility of some other place essential to her, propelling her to the Mecca, propelling her to New York and then beyond. On her 30th birthday, she took a trip to Paris. I am not sure you remember. You were only 6. We spent that week eating fried fish for breakfast and cake for dinner, leaving underwear on the counter and blasting Ghostface Killah. It had never occurred to me to leave America, not even temporarily. My eyes. My friend Jelani, who came up the same as me, once said that he used to think of traveling as a pointless luxury, like blowing the rent check on a pink suit. And I felt much the same then. I was bemused at your mother's dreams of Paris. I could not understand them, and I did not think I needed to. Some part of me was still back in that 7th grade French class, thinking only of the immediate security of my body, regarding France as one might regard Jupiter. But now your mother had gone and done it, and when she returned, her eyes were dancing with all the possibilities out there, not just for her, but for you and for me. It is quite ridiculous how the feeling spread. It was like falling in love. The things that get you are so small. The things that keep you up at night are so particular to you that when you try to explain, the only reward anyone can give you is a dumb, polite nod. Your mother had taken many pictures, all through Paris, of doors, giant doors, deep blue, ebony, orange, turquoise, and burning red doors. I examined the pictures of these giant doors in our small Harlem apartment. I had never seen anything like them. It had never occurred to me that such giant doors could exist, could be so common in one part of the world and totally absent in another. And it occurred to me, listening to your mother, that France was not a thought experiment, but an actual place filled with actual people whose traditions were different, whose lives really were different, whose sense of beauty was different. When I look back, I know that I was then getting the message from all over. By that time, my friends included a great number of people with ties to different worlds. Make the race proud, the elders used to say. But by then, I knew that I wasn't so much bound to a biological race as to a group of people, and these people were not black because of any uniform color or any uniform physical feature. They were bound because they suffered under the weight of the dream, and they were bound by all the beautiful things, all the language and mannerisms, all the food and music, all the literature and philosophy, all the common language that they had fashioned like diamonds under the weight of the dream. Not long ago, I was standing in an airport retrieving a bag from a conveyor belt. I bumped into a young black man and said, "My bad." Without even looking up, he said, "You straight." And in that exchange, there was so much of the private rapport that can only exist between two particular strangers of this tribe that we call black. In other words, I was part of a world. And looking out, I had friends who too were part of other worlds. The world of Jews or New Yorkers, the world of Southerners or gay men, of immigrants, of Californians, of Native Americans, or a combination of any of these worlds stitched into worlds like tapestry. And though I could never myself be a native of any of these worlds, I knew that nothing so essentialist as race stood between us. I had read too much by then, and my eyes, my beautiful, precious eyes, were growing stronger each day. And I saw that what divided me from the world was not anything intrinsic to us, but the actual injury done by people intent on naming us, intent on believing that what they have named us matters more than anything we could ever actually do. In America, the injury is not in being born with darker skin, with fuller lips, with a broader nose, but in everything that happens after. In that single exchange with that young man, I was speaking the personal language of my people. It was the briefest intimacy, but it captured much of the beauty of my black world, the ease between your mother and me, the miracle at the Mecca, the way I feel myself disappear on the streets of Harlem. To call that feeling racial is to hand over all those diamonds fashioned by our ancestors to the plunderer. We made that feeling, though it was forged in the shadow of the murdered, the raped, the disembodied. We made it all the same. This is the beautiful thing that I have seen with my own eyes, and I think I needed this vantage point before I could journey out. I think I needed to know that I was from somewhere, that my home was as beautiful as any other. 7 years after I saw the pictures of those doors, I received my first adult passport. I wish I had come to it sooner. I wish when I was back in that French class that I had connected the conjugations, verbs, and gendered nouns to something grander. I wish someone had told me what that class really was, a gate to some other blue world. I wanted to see that world myself, to see the doors and everything behind them. The day of my departure, I sat in a restaurant with your mother, who'd shown me so much. I told her, "I am afraid. I didn't really speak the language. I did not know the customs. I would be alone." She just listened and held my hand. And that night, I boarded a starship. The starship punched out into the dark, punched through the sky, punched out past West Baltimore, punched out past the Mecca, past New York, past any language and every spectrum known to me. My ticket took me to Geneva first. Everything happened very fast. I had to change money. I needed to find a train from the airport into the city, and after that find another train to Paris. Some months earlier, I had begun a halting study of the French language. Now I was in a storm of French, drenched really, and only equipped to catch drops of the language. Who? Euros. You. To the right. I was still very afraid. I surveyed the railway schedule and became aware that I was one wrong ticket from Vienna, Milan, or some Alpine village that no one I knew had ever heard of. It happened right then. The realization of being far gone, the fear, the unknowable possibilities, all of it, the horror, the wonder, the joy, fused into an erotic thrill. The thrill was not wholly alien. It was close to the wave that came over me in Moreland. It was kin to the narcotic shot I'd gotten watching the people with their wine glasses spill out onto West Broadway. It was all that I'd felt looking at those Parisian doors. And at that moment, I realized that those changes, with all their agony, awkwardness, and confusion, were the defining fact of my life. And for the first time, I knew not only that I really was alive, that I really was studying and observing, but that I had long been alive, even back in Baltimore. I had always been alive. I was always translating. I arrived in Paris. I checked into a hotel in the 6th arrondissement. I had no understanding of the local history at all. I did not think much about Baldwin or Wright. I had not read Sartre nor Camus, and if I walked past Café de Flore or Les Deux Magots, I did not then take any particular note. None of that mattered. It was Friday, and what mattered were the streets thronged with people in amazing configurations, teenagers together in cafes, school children kicking a soccer ball on the street, backpacks to the side, older couples in long coats, billowing scarves and blazers, 20-somethings leaning out of any number of establishments looking beautiful and cool. It recalled New York, but without the low-grade, ever-present fear. The people wore no armor, or none that I recognized. Side streets and alleys were bursting with bars, restaurants, and cafes. Everyone was walking. Those who were not walking were embracing. I was feeling myself beyond any natural right. My Caesar was geometric. My lineup was sharp as a sword. I walked outside and melted into the city like butter in the stew. In my mind, I heard Big Boy sing. I'm just a player like that. My jeans were sharply creased. I got a fresh white t-shirt and my cap is slightly pointed east. I had dinner with a friend. The restaurant was the size of 2 large living rooms. The tables were jammed together, and to be seated, the waitress employed a kind of magic, pulling one table out and then wedging you in like a child in a high chair. You had to summon her to use the toilet. When it was time to order, I flailed at her with my catastrophic French. She nodded and did not laugh. She gave no false manners. We had an incredible bottle of wine. I had steak. I had a baguette with bone marrow. I had liver. I had an espresso and a dessert I can't even name. Using all the French I could muster, I tried to tell the waitress the meal was magnificent. She cut me off in English. The best you've ever had, right? I rose to walk, and despite having inhaled half the menu, I felt easy as a featherweight. The next day I got up early and walked through the city. I visited the Musée Rodin. I stopped in a bistro, and with all the fear of a boy approaching a beautiful girl at a party, I ordered 2 beers and then a burger. I walked to Les Jardins du Luxembourg. It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I took a seat. The garden was bursting with people, again, in all their alien ways. At that moment, a strange loneliness took hold. Perhaps it was that I had not spoken a single word of English that entire day. Perhaps it was that I had never sat in a public garden before, had not even known it to be something I'd want to do. And all around me there were people who did this regularly. It occurred to me that I really was in someone else's country, and yet, in some necessary way, I was outside of their country. In America, I was part of an equation, even if it wasn't a part I relished. I was the one the police stopped on 23rd Street in the middle of a work day. I was the one driven to the Mecca. I was not just the father, but the father of a black boy. I was not just the spouse, but the husband of a black woman, a freighted symbol of black love. But sitting in that garden, for the first time, I was an alien. I was a sailor, landless and disconnected. And I was sorry that I had never felt this particular loneliness before, that I had never felt myself so far outside of someone else's dream. Now I felt the deeper weight of my generational chains, my body, confined by history and policy to certain zones. Some of us make it out, but the game is played with loaded dice. I wished I had known more, and I wished I had known it sooner. I remember that night watching the teenagers gathering along the pathway near the Seine to do all their teenage things. And I remember thinking how much I would have loved for that to have been my life, how much I would have loved to have a past apart from the fear. I did not have that past in hand or memory, but I had you. We came back to Paris that summer because your mother loved the city and because I loved the language, but above all, because of you. I wanted you to have your own life apart from fear, even apart from me. I am wounded. I am marked by old codes which shielded me in one world and then chained me in the next. I think of your grandmother calling me and noting how you were growing tall and would one day try to test me. And I said to her that I would regard that day, should it come, as the total failure of fatherhood, because if all I had over you were my hands, then I really had nothing at all. But forgive me, son. I knew what she meant. And when you were younger, I thought the same. And I am now ashamed of the thought, ashamed of my fear, of the generational chains I tried to clasp onto your wrists. We are entering our last years together, and I wish I had been softer with you. Your mother had to teach me how to love you, how to kiss you, and tell you I love you every night. Even now, it does not feel a wholly natural act so much as it feels like ritual, and that is because I am wounded.